Crawl House Ass Together. It's 10 minutes after 1. Today's what? 16th. Yeah.
Dream on.
416. Yeah, would you call the roll, please?
Yes. Representative Gruenberg?
Here.
Representative Foster?
Here.
Representative Ledoux? Representative Lynn?
Here.
Representative Millett? Representative Pruitt? Representative Keller?
Here. Okay, with that, what we're going to do, if you remember on the record, I promised SCR2 first. The sponsor has graciously agreed to stand aside because of just trying to adjust the for everybody's schedule. And we're going to start with SJR 23. Senator Faircloth, if you would come up and identify yourself for the record and tell us about SJR 23.
And do we need to move this, Mr. Chair?
Would you move for, the version, the working version?
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Joint Resolution Number 23-LS1394/Uniform.
Seeing no objection, that's the one that you'll be explaining then. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is Senator Anna Faircloth. I represent East Anchorage and Eagle River. Before you today, you have an opportunity to reduce student loan debt for those students in Alaska who choose to borrow money. Mr. Chairman, our forefathers could never have thought about the student loan debt that this nation currently carries, or an individual student carries, in their effort to seek a life in the professional sector. The Alaska Student Loan Corporation under this bill would have the power to issue debt with the full faith and credit of the state of Alaska. In very short, what that means is we can offer a lower interest rate to students. That's it, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lynn?
What is the interest rate now? What might the interest rate be with this resolution?
Currently, we offer a 7.30 interest rate from the corporation. If we were able to use the full faith and credit, we expect to see at least a 1% drop in that rate. I have another bill that is in the House Finance Committee that would help streamline other parts of the student loan corporation, as well as how student loans are provided in the state of Alaska.
Thank you.
Okay, seeing no questions, I have nobody online to testify. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify? Okay, I'll close public testimony, and it's before the committee. And is there discussion, or can we move this bill?
Yeah.
Yes, what? You going to move it? Thank you.
I can't get a word in edgewise.
Representative Gruenberg, you have the floor.
Yeah, thank you. And I was talking to the bill sponsor here earlier. I've had various pieces of legislation in over the years, the last being House Joint Resolution 31, which simply removes all limiting language from that section. So it would no longer be limited to capital improvements or housing loans for veterans, or now, assuming this passes, post-secondary student loans. And I don't want to burden this bill or cause problems or anything, and that's not my interest. I'm glad to see we're moving in this direction, because this is one of a very few provisions in the Constitution. This one sentence now will have been amended twice, mainly because different subjects come up for loans than they had in the mid-1950s. And at some point, we'll probably want some loans floated that may allow us to enter into some business deals, finance pipelines or various things that may not be capital construction, but maybe things that just technically don't fit under one of these things. And I want the future legislatures, long after all of us are gone, or at least some of us old guys are gone, and maybe even after that.
Like 20 years from now.
Yeah. So that the legislatures can run the state with the most flexibility possible. And I'm looking at the former chair of the Finance Committee, who may be involved in the future too, both of you on the Finance Committee. And I'm an options person. I'd like the legislature to be able to determine whether they need to use this as a method. And I don't know if any of you saw the article in the paper by former Governor Frank Murkowski, where a few days ago, I think it was in the Juno Empire, it was an op-ed piece urging that the permanent fund be used for this, and I don't think we should have to use the permanent fund. Anyway, I don't want to take time, but I appreciate if the sponsor's willing to work with us and see where we go from here.
Yeah, thank you for putting it on the record. It gives us food for thought for where we go next year. Vice Chair Lynn.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I would happily move Senate Joint Resolution number 23-28-LS1394 / uniform individual recommendation to any attached fiscal notes.
Okay, seeing no objection, we've done our first work for the day.
Good.
Thank
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What we're going to do is we're not going to take an at ease. We're just going to keep right on going and go to SCR2. So if the
just Mr. Chair, just for the record, I've had a alleged research paper done, which we can have the committee distribute, on the very few sections of the Constitution that have been amended more than once. There are only two others.
Huh.
And they're not at all. One deals with terms of legislators and other deals with the number of judges and stuff. Nothing at all like this. Huh. Very unusual.
Yeah, it is.
I'll see what we can.
So, Senator Stedman, if you'd go come and introduce yourself for the on the record and tell us about SCR2.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Bert Stedman. I'm the senator from District Q, which is pretty much the vast majority of the landmass in Southeast. Doesn't include Juneau, doesn't include Skagway, and currently Petersburg, but the vast majority of it. Today, before the committee, is SCR2 dealing with the Tongass. But before I go, I'd like to get a little direction, if I could, from the chairman as far as short version, medium version, time frame, because I know it's end of session. I can, and I'm at the disposal of the chairman to do whatever form he would like.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. I appreciate the question. My wish would be brevity, but I will put it on the committee members if questions, if they want to expand. But as long as you've given me the opportunity, I have, I'm very enthusiastic about your resolution, and I would like to see us move it with dispatch, partly because of what it does. It's a good resolution. So,
okay.
So go ahead and give us the short version, and then I will submit to the guidance of the committee members if they have questions.
Do we need to move this?
Oh, please do. Give me the right version. Thank you, Vice Chair.
Then. I have Charlie, right?
Charlie, right.
Mr. Chair, I would move CS for Senate concurrent resolution number 2, Judiciary. That's 28-LS0676 / Charlie.
For our working copy.
For our working copy. Working.
No objections. So short version. Thank you.
Okay. And I'll do a fairly short version. Mr. Chairman, a little over 100 years ago, 1907, the Tongass National Forest was created in the territory of Alaska, and since then we all know we became a state, but in the process of moving forward with this vast national forest amongst us at the end of World War II, Japan needed a timber supply, and part of the General Douglas MacArthur's plan to rebuild Japan was securing a supply of timber. They looked to Southeast Alaska for that, and that helped in the creation of one of the pulp mills in Southeast. Another in one happened to be in Sitka, the other one was put in Ketchikan, and they each had a sawmill. Sitka's pulp mill's sawmill location was in Wrangell. Ketchikan's sawmill location was in Ketchikan. And as we fast forward, you know, the economics of that time was clearly to get year-round jobs in Southeast Alaska, and that was part of the reason during statehood that there wasn't vast tracts of the Southeast selected for state lands. It was a federal forest, and the federal government was taking care of year-round jobs. Well, the political climate has changed since then, Mr. Chairman, and substantially changed. Neither one of the two pulp mills ran their 50-year timber contracts. They were both short on the time frame. Today, we're faced with the closure and removal of those. Both sawmills are gone. We've got one medium-sized sawmill left on Prince of Wales Island, and pretty much the rest of the timber industry is gone relative to the way it stood 30 years ago. Equivalent to, in size would be if Anchorage lost the airport or Ketchikan lost its military bases. So basically that's what happened to Southeast. A third of our economy and livable wage jobs disappeared. So what we're trying to do now is to stabilize the economy in Southeast, and as I'm sure you're all aware, when we look at the demographics across the state, Southeast has been pretty much paralyzed for quite some time. All the growth is in Anchorage and in Mat-Su, and there was some forecast a few years ago of the Southeast losing up to 20 to 30% of its population. I think through the action of the legislature and hard work of many others, we've saw that that's not going to happen. We now have fairly flat population, which is a great improvement as far as the target. But we could do better. And in trying to ensure timber supply for the remaining sawmill and ensure timber supplies for a lot of the smaller operators, and then also have state control and more local control, which is, I think, is the best direction for the entire country, to give the control to the local people as much as absolutely possible, is to get some land selection out of the Tongass. If we're unable to go to the Statehood Act and get land through the Statehood Act, we should encourage, which this resolution does, encourage a discussion by the governor with the federal government to just outright purchase some of it and do whatever we can to get the land, more land, into the state of Alaska's hands, and for that matter, other private individuals' hands, residents of Alaska, and or some of the native corporations. I think the less federal land the government, the U.S. government, has in Alaska, the better the state is. Clearly, we are a resource extraction state. We're different from the East Coast in the population basis, and it makes it very difficult for us to maintain a stable population and livable year-round jobs when the economic strings are pushed and pulled out of Washington versus out of Juneau or out of City Hall in Ketchikan or Juneau or Sitka or Wrangell, Petersburg, Craig, or wherever, Metlakatla, Cape Angoon. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's kind of the short view of why I think it's important that the legislature supports the governor in his endeavors to push back against the federal government and try to get some privatized or private land owned by the state out of the Tongass. And that's in a nutshell what it is.
Thank you. For the record, President Ledoux has joined us. I just want to say that I'm on CACFA, on the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas. We had a summit last summer on federal overreach, and we got some testimony pretty clearly that that the U.S. Forest Service has gone from a philosophy of a working force. They used to call it a working force concept, and they're moving away from that to preservation, and that certainly has been borne out both by what you have and the whereases and what you just testified. So that's a really good move. Any other questions? Seeing none, what we'll do is go right to public testimony. We have three or four. Let's start with Dick Coos. Are you online from Ketchikan?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Yeah, if you would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony on SCR 2.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. My name is Dick Coos, Ketchikan. I'm speaking for myself. I'm a retired Forest Service employee with 34 years of service. I worked as a professional forester land manager on the Tongass for 14 years before I retired, and I support SCR 2. I regret to have to say this, but in my professional opinion, the federal government no longer has the desire or the capability to properly manage the federal lands for the health of the lands and the benefit of the local people. I foresee little hope that the feds will change their attitude. The state of Alaska has a proven record for good forest land management. The Statehood Act limitation of 400,000 acres are proper and okay when there were two pulp mills operating on the Tongass, but today that limitation is not necessary those mills were driven out of the business by the feds. The state of Alaska would be the best manager of these Tongass National Forest lands. The state needs to take the ownership and management of the whole Tongass, or at least select 5 million acres of the forest. Please pass the resolution. Thank you, sir.
And thank you for your testimony, Dick. Let's go to David Beebe, Kuperoff.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is David Beebe, and I'm representing the city of Kuperoff on Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 2. SCR 2 is at odds with Article 8, Section 4 of Alaska's Constitution, which mandates the management of fish, forests, and wildlife under sustained yield principles. Sustained yield requires that ecosystem services function without significant impairment. The state of Alaska has long known that significant impairment of southeast forest habitat structure and function precludes the sustainable yield of Sitka black-tailed deer. A major symposium held in Juneau in 1978 on Sitka black-tailed deer documented the concern for future deer populations from clear-cut logging. In 1993, the Alaska Board of Game passed a resolution unanimously recommending the protection of high-volume, old-growth forests because the board, quote, is mandated by the Alaska Constitution to manage wildlife resources on a sustained yield basis for all of the people of Alaska, close quote. Emergency closures and significant restrictions on deer hunting presently exist in a 20-mile or more radius surrounding the city of Kuperoff. These are not new problems. Midcoff Island first suffered severe restrictions to its deer populations in the early 70s. The deer numbers aren't recovering 40 years later. The structure and function of this habitat, according to the best available science, will not be restored for two centuries or more. If SCR2 passes and its ultimate ends achieved, we can expect a much larger rural subsistence predicament born of a pervasive denial of this systematic management failure to occur across more of southeast Alaska. Gordon Harrison, the author of Alaska's Constitution, A Citizen's Guide, noted that Alaska's delegate to Congress, Bob Bartlett, and his fellow delegates wanted to defend, quote, against freewheeling disposals of public resources and colonial-style exploitation, close quote. However, that is precisely the central premise of the language in SCR 2. In conclusion, Alaska's Constitution establishes the obligation of the government, including the legislature, to assure sustained yield management. I'm testifying today because I took an oath of office to defend the Constitution of the State of Alaska. I ask you to also uphold the same oath that you took by voting no on letting SCR 2 out of committee. Thank you for this opportunity to comment.
Thank you for calling and putting that on the record. We appreciate it, and I don't see any questions at this time. James Sullivan? You would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is James Sullivan, and I work for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. We also oppose SCR 2. This resolution proposes a return to a timber-first forest policy on our salmon forest. It attacks the Forest Service's attempt to create an integrated forest plan that takes into account the numerous aspects and uses of the Tongass National Forest. This resolution ignores the needs and desires of the local communities in Southeast Alaska to cater to a single industry. Federal law requires the Tongass to assure the multi-use and sustained yield of all renewable forest resources and their uses. State forests are managed primarily for sustained use of timber. We believe this focus on timber is in direct conflict with Alaska State Constitution. Mr. Chairman, the big thing here is that Southeast has adapted to a new Tongass. I know the sponsor, when he came up and spoke about after World War II, the best choices and the decisions made then made a great deal of sense. but we feel that this is a step back in time, and it's a step in the wrong direction. The Tongass and the communities surrounding and among the Tongass have transitioned to a new economy and are improving the wages and quality of life. In the most recent release, or I guess annual report, from the Southeast Conference, I'll quote, as they say, it is a good time to live and work in Southeast Alaska. The economy of Southeast Alaska is in an expansion phase and has been since 2008. Between 2010 and 2012, the economic growth of the region has intensified in nearly every single economic indicator, for the region is up and continues to rise. They also stated in that same document that the region has more workers than ever before at 46,000, along with the highest total payroll, even when adjusted for inflation. Southeast Alaska has gone through a very difficult transition starting in the 90s with the loss of those two pulp mills. But then transition is happening. Southeast Alaska is diversifying. It is turning into a more vibrant economy. And we respectfully ask that this committee keep this resolution here, do not pass it on, and let the Tongass transition the way it is. The sponsor of this resolution has stated in a previous committee that he put this resolution up for a desire to open a discussion about the Tongass. But any discussion about land use should acknowledge the Tongass as a salmon forest and incorporate tourism, fishing industry, subsistence use, and energy, along with timber. All those issues, which are very important to all Southeast Alaskans, are being ignored in this resolution, and that's, in our opinion, a big mistake. I don't want to say for one second that we want to kill the timber industry. We want a timber industry that fits within all these other industries that can work together and not kill those industries, and also kill a certain way of life and lifestyle that was mentioned by the previous speaker about the needs of subsistence and the needs of our small communities within here, within the Tongass. We'd also encourage the governor and the legislature to establish mechanisms for developing government-to-government relationships and processes that would, with the different tribes and tribal organizations within Southeast Alaska, that would enable them for better use of the resources for those tribes.
James,
much.
Lynn has a question.
Well,
for
no,
you.
Let
finish.
Okay.
And that's really all I have to say, Mr. Okay. Chairman. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for coming and giving your testimony, Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much for coming here today. Just for general information, do you have any idea how many jobs have been lost? Do you have any idea how many jobs have been lost due to the basic shutdown of the forestry industry, and how much revenue has been lost to the state of Alaska because of the restrictions on forest harvesting?
So in relation to the jobs lost,
yes,
from the two pulp mills, I believe there were over 500 jobs lost back in the early 90s. I would remind you that currently we have the most job growth in Southeast Alaska that's ever been at this current time. Now, timber is a much smaller part of that industry for Southeast Alaska. And though we've lost the two large pulp mills and we've diminished the number of exporting that goes out of export logs that are occurring, we do have well over a dozen very small mills within our communities that are all working. And we would encourage this legislature to find ways of enhancing and finding ways to help those small mills which live in the community and are creating jobs in the community and putting food on the plates of their families and helping them access, and for the most part they do have access to enough wood and to enough timber, but helping them diversify.
And the revenue, how much revenue has been lost to the state of Alaska because of what some would call the shutdown of the forest industry in the Tongass?
I'd say there is no shutdown of the forest. Over 150 million board feet were taken last year out of the Tongass areas, if you include private, state, and federal lands.
Yeah.
But I don't know the total revenues.
Okay. Thank you very much.
I just wanted to ask you, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game already has primary management responsibilities for the wildlife in Southeast. Do you feel like that they will be incapable of this kind of go? Maybe I shouldn't ask you. I should have asked the last person that testified. But if we get more land under state ownership, I personally believe DNR is totally capable of handling that, you know, and continuing their management policies on fish and game.
Fish and game? I don't think the danger is who's actually managing our wildlife. I think the danger is that what are we doing to the habitat and the decisions that we are going to place upon those agencies, be they federal agencies, state, or local agencies. When we've degraded that habitat, we're going to force them into decisions that they don't want to make. And we don't want to see these type of decisions where, like, Endangered Species Act and the other issues that might pull into place that could actually affect these small communities.
Yeah. That's anyway, but thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Did you have a question, Representative Grunberg? I see that look on your face like you might have one.
Waiting in anticipation.
We have some other people who are going to testify.
No.
Oh, this is it. Okay. I haven't intimately lived with the issue like you have, or like the other folks who've testified and people from other parts of the state, and the bill sponsor. It seems to me there are a couple of issues, and they're being mixed together here, maybe on purpose, maybe not. But the mixing of the two issues is having a decided effect on the tenor of the discussion. The first issue is whether Alaska should be entitled to get the remainder of its promised acreage. A sub-issue is whether it should be in the Tongass Forest. A different issue is if the state acquires the land, what should the use of the land be? And I think that the second issue may not be ripe yet until we get the land.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. In fact, I would rather not make that a dialogue between you and the testifier, because the new plan is still, you know, there's a lot of talk about the revised T-Lump Tongass Management Plan that's still coming. And, yeah, that's future. I couldn't agree with you more on what you said.
You don't want me to continue, though.
If you have a question.
Well, my first question was, does that seem like a way of analyzing it? And it sounds like it might be. And my next question was to the world in general, mainly you. Do you want us at this point to discuss at all the issue of whether Alaska should be entitled to proceed with its selections, and if so, where?
I think the question posed by the bill, and I would ask the sponsor to straighten this out if I don't say it right, is to support the governor's attempt to negotiate for land settlement that includes the Tongass for improvement of the timber supply in Southeast Alaska. I think that is the issue very clearly in the resolution. And if we, if we get muddied up on the side, you know, we can do that later. So
okay, and I don't have anything else. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I'll just say that in regards to the T-Lump and the issues there, regardless of who is actually managing the land, it would be our hope that the acres that they're in charge of would be held for a common use and acknowledge the multi-uses for the forest, because they're very important. Land use is a very personal right. Thank you.
Right, which includes a working forest, so thank you.
Yes, sir.
Did you want to wrap up, Senator Stedman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarity, the intent of the land selection within the Tongass is broader than just a supply of timber. Clearly, there's a timber supply issue. But there's a lot of recreational needs, multi-use needs. The state already has state forest in the Tongass, and it manages it that way. So the intent here isn't to get land from the federal government and then clear-cut it all, but to get it in control of the state so the state then can control its own destiny. And that would include timber supply, would include recreational, hunting, fishing. And as far as some of the game issues, I think the state's been a very good steward of the game. Where I live in Sitka, I can shoot six deer, my wife can shoot six, my daughter can shoot six. We get limited by how much the family wants to eat, not how many deer tickets that I get issued from Fish and Game.
I see no questions, but I'm going to take a chance. Go just a little. I want to know if you what Senator Stedman. Do you know anything about the Alexander Archipelago wolf that they have initiated a status review? I know it's speculation on whether or not that has any impact on whether it's in state ownership or federal ownership, but it's just another one of those issues I think that could have a huge impact. Do you have any comment? Does it tie at all, I guess, with the land?
I think if there's the southeast wolf, there's the spotted owl, there's a multitude of issues, or animals and both on the surface and swimming in the water column, that you could point to as an excuse to keep federal control. Where I live on Baranoff Island, there are no wolves. We have brown bear on Admiralty Baranoff and Chichikov. So I'm not as exposed to that as the rest of my district personally. But if, in my opinion, if it wasn't for the wolf, it'd be just another creature.
Okay.
This is development versus non-development, basic argument.
Fair enough. We're going to close public testimony at this time and before the committee for discussion or action.
Mr. Chair, if there's no discussion forthcoming, I would move the bill.
Please do.
I would move CS for Senate concurrent resolution number
two.
Number two, Judiciary, 20-L-S-0676/C, individual recommendations and any attached fiscal notes.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gruber?
I'd just like to put one sentence on the record for me.
Okay, I'll object for your purposes.
Thank you. Yeah. I would like to see what we can do consistent with good management practices to help the economy down here. We are all Alaskans, and it's time we tried to do something to help this area, the state, and others. I don't want to just point to one, but I'd like to see what we can do to work together here. And the legislature ought to have a role in that too, and ought to be positive in the effort.
You're here. I'll remove my objection. Seeing
she had her hand up.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I thought you had your hand.
Okay. Seeing no other objection, SCR 2 moves from committee. And that's bring us to SB 170. And what I'll do is ask the sponsor to come up and get ready, and we'll just press on here and pass the paperwork as we go. Again, in the best interest of time. And when you're situated, if you would kind of tell us where we are, and if you would try to help us understand the some of the testimony we got last time, public testimony, which didn't, wasn't real positive, and I just would like to give you a chance to explain that.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Berta Gardner, Senator for Midtown Anchorage, District H. And I think we were less than completely thorough last time because we were trying to be so fast, and I think that resulted in some confusion. So what I'll just be, again, as brief as I can, but with more thoroughness. Right now, 23 states and others in progress offer an affirmative defense against prostitution charges, as we're proposing to do here. And when we talked with law enforcement about it, including the FBI and police officers, they're very enthusiastic about this tool for going after traffickers. Those who are opposed, and you heard them at the last hearing, are opposed because they say it doesn't go far enough. There are some who want to decriminalize prostitution completely and vacate previous convictions. There are those who want to decriminalize or vacate convictions of trafficking victims and offer also immunity for other offenses. Sometimes trafficking victims are forced to carry and use or sell drugs, and if it's related to their being trafficked, they want to vacate those as well. I mean, all of those proposals are worth consideration, but we're not going there with this bill. Because the heart of this bill is very simple. Two things. One is to not re-victimize sex trafficked victims by prosecuting them for prostitution, and the other is to help law enforcement go after traffickers. And Steve Handy will speak to some of the other issues that were raised about the burden of proof and such, and we also have Annie Carpinetti here to help, and we have a couple, I believe, of private defense attorneys who will speak to the committee about how these things and the proposal works in the real world.
Just for the committee, so you know, we have two private, I believe, defense attorneys, and we have Quinlan Steiner, public defender, on for to answer questions.
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For the record, my name is Steve Handy, and I work in the office of Senator Berta Gardner. When we adjourned this committee last time, I think the main concern was how the affirmative defense would hurt the victim. There was concern that this would subject them to intense scrutiny from prosecution, force them to testify and all this. The simple fact of the matter is affirmative defense is just that. It ends right there. The affirmative defense is offered. It must be declared pretrial, and then in trial it's given to the jury. If the jury believes the burden of evidence is the preponderance of that evidence, which is the lowest form of evidence. The jury has to believe only that the person was subject to some kind of, they're induced or caused to engage in that act. If they believe that, and that person, and the victim is excused at that point, that is it. There's no obligation to prosecution. There's no obligation to negotiate. That is it. Game over. I do hope that addresses the majority of the question there. And yeah, that was the good senator addressed the other major questions, I believe, after listening to the recording of last meeting. I believe that was, we covered the bulk of the argument there. Are there any other questions?
Okay, any further questions from the committee? Seeing none?
Reserving the right to.
We're going to move to public testimony. We'll start with Scott Dutton, is it?
Hello, my name is...
I understand you are a defense attorney. You give us your testimony, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually didn't prepare a speech. I thought...
We can barely hear you, so if you speak right into your mic or whatever and try one more time.
I can try to speak up.
There you go. Yes, that's better.
Defense attorney in Anchorage, Alaska. I do a lot of federal criminal defense and some state defense.
Did I get the name right? You state your name so it's clearly on the record.
It's Dattan. Dattan, pronounced like Manhattan.
Okay. Scott, right?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, that's quite all right. After discussing this bill with Mr. Handy, it just occurs to me that it's an appropriate thing to do. The affirmative defense should be offered to young women who are indeed pressed into this sort of occupation and illegal conduct. I prefer to answer questions because I don't have a prepared speech, but certainly I don't see any negative aspect of it to a defendant because she can choose not to offer the defense if it is somehow uncomfortable. On the other hand, the defense would be available, statutorily available, if a defendant and her attorney chose to avail themselves of it.
Okay, I don't see any questions. Representative Grunberg has one.
Yes, I'd just like to note for the record that my old friend, longtime friend, not old, a longtime friend, Scott Dutton, who also is a fine family lawyer, and we've tried cases together. He's a wise person and a good guy, and thank you very much for testifying, and we would value your advice and other lawyers on this issue and others, and glad to hear your voice.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Scott. Wally Tetlow?
Good afternoon, Chairman Keller.
If you would, identify yourself for the record. We can hear you and give us your testimony on SB 170. Thank you.
My name is Wally Tetlow. I am a partner at the law firm Tetlow Christie here in Anchorage, Alaska. I have practiced criminal defense in state courts here in Alaska for just over 20 years. First, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak on this important piece of legislation, SB 170. I'd like to speak in support of the bill, address any concerns about the bill, and also answer any questions that you may have about how the affirmative defense will play out in the criminal justice system. SB 170 provides an opportunity for an individual charged with prostitution to prove to a jury that at the time of the act charged, they were induced to do so by sex traffickers. The bill does not provide a free pass to engage in prostitution. It provides an affirmative defense. I understand that there was a concern about if the affirmative defense was available, that perhaps more victims of sex traffickers or alleged prostitutes would come forward, provide information, and thereby make themselves the targets of law enforcement and potentially charges of prostitution. The bill, in actuality, the affirmative defense will not do that. It will have the opposite effect. First of all, with law enforcement support behind the bill, I think the last thing that the Department of Law or law enforcement would want to have happen is victims of sex traffickers come forward to reveal information about sex traffickers to law enforcement, and then law enforcement turn around and punish those individuals, if you will, by charging them with offenses. I don't see that occurring. The way the affirmative defense actually works in the real world is that at trial, the defense must produce some evidence in support of the defense in order to even have the jury decide whether the defense applies. So the first thing that happens in court is that the defense is required to put on some evidence to justify the jury instruction that would go to the jury and allow the jury to consider the issue. If there is no evidence offered in support of the affirmative defense, the jury never gets the issue. So that's the first hurdle. The second hurdle is that the jury decides by a preponderance of the evidence whether or not the defense applies. And it is the defendant's burden to prove the defense, but the jury's decision. Ultimately, the affirmative defense not only plays out at trial, but in many cases, it will play out before trial, thereby lessening the anxiety and pressure and stress on the victim of sex trafficking, because trials are stressful. They produce a lot of anxiety for the defendant. Normally, in criminal cases, long before the case ever goes to trial, there is a negotiation phase. And in that phase, oftentimes, criminal defense attorneys will offer information to the prosecutor that in an effort to convince the prosecutor to dismiss charges. And plea negotiations are often quite successful in weeding out cases that should go to trial versus cases that should not go to trial. So the hope would be that in the vast majority of cases where alleged prostitutes are in fact victims of sex traffickers, that the defense can relay this information to the prosecution. The prosecution can check the information, make sure that it's valid, and they can elect to dismiss the charges if they choose to do so. I understand that there was also some concern about additional stress being placed upon the victim of sex trafficking, because if the victim of sex traffickers provides information about sex traffickers, there was a concern that they would thereby make themselves witnesses against the sex traffickers and have to testify against sex traffickers and be subject to cross-examination and all the stress and anxiety that comes along with that. The fact of the matter is simply by offering such evidence at trial or even offering such evidence in the negotiation phase, the victim of sex trafficking does not automatically make themselves a witness against sex traffickers. The victim can elect not to cooperate in the prosecution of sex traffickers if they choose to do so. Additionally, oftentimes, victims of sex traffickers may not always be the best witnesses for the prosecutors who are going to prosecute the sex traffickers or the law enforcement agencies that are going to investigate and apprehend the sex traffickers. Law enforcement and prosecutors will certainly want to amass more evidence than simply the testimony of the sex trafficking victim in order to apprehend and prosecute sex traffickers. Oftentimes, the information provided by the victim of the sex traffickers will allow law enforcement to pursue other avenues that they might not be aware of and will preclude the necessity of having the victim of sex trafficking subject to further anxiety or stress caused by being a witness for the prosecution against the sex trafficker. That's all I have to say in support of the bill. I wanted to thank you for this opportunity to speak on behalf of the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you all. You probably answered this, but I'm going to ask it anyway just to help me understand it. Maybe you say it in different words. But the if a victim chooses not to become a witness, is the affirmative defense still available? It's not, is it? I mean, that's what, you know, am I wrong, right or wrong?
Well, I think we're talking about two separate things, Chairman. In the prostitution trial of the sex trafficking victim, there are a number of ways for the victim to present the affirmative defense, and one of the ways is that the victim, I'm going to call them, just so it's clear we're talking about the same thing, I'll call them the victim slash defendant. The victim slash defendant can certainly testify on their own behalf at their own trial, but they don't have to. There are other ways of establishing the affirmative defense without having the victim slash defendant testify. I guess my comments were more directed to the concern that not only would the victim slash defendant have to perhaps testify in their own trial, but they might also then be the subject of a subpoena by prosecutors to testify in subsequent trials other than their own.
Okay, that helps. I understand now. You probably said that, like I say, and I missed it. Any other questions for Wally? Okay, thank you so much for taking time to call.
Thank you very much, Chairman, and other committee members.
Quinlan, I know you're just there for questions, but after listening, maybe you have something you want to add.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Quinlan.
Quinlan, that was not really understandable, but try it one more time into the mic.
For the state of Alaska.
Okay, you're in and out, but did you have something you wanted to add to the discussion?
I don't think how it would work was.
I'm sorry, Quinlan, but it isn't going to work. So thank you. If you have any written testimony, you can call my office and we can get it to you, get it to the committee.
Okay.
But with that, we're going to close public testimony. I don't see anybody else in the room. And that puts SB 170 version uniform, it's 1232 uniform that we had in front of us for discussion or action. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. I just wanted to thank the sponsor for bringing this legislation before us because, you know, not only is it good for all victims across the state, but for me, coming from a rural area, particularly Alaska Natives who, you know, come from rural areas and they end up in places where they have little or no support group and are easily influenced. So just appreciate that.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would concur in Representative Foster's remarks. I would move Senate Bill number 170 from this committee. That's 28-LS1232/uniform with individual recommendations and any attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objections, congratulations.
Thank you very much.
That's a good bill.
Thank you.
Okay, what we're going to do now is press right on to SB 173. And just to give the committee an update of where we're at, I think you all have a copy of the memo from Legal Services from Kathleen Strassbaugh that addressed the questions that came up last time in committee. And she also supplied us with a new CS that I'm going to ask the vice chair to move here in a bit so that we're here. It is right here if you want to use that one. And so, and then we'll ask the sponsor staff to tell us where we're at.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would move House CS for Senate Bill number 173, 28-LS1242/Yankee for discussion.
Okay, seeing no objection, we have version Yankee in front of us. Go ahead and state your name and give us any updates.
Okay, good afternoon, Chair Keller, members of the committee. Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer. Just real briefly, at our last meeting, we had some comments from the Department of Law, some suggested language changes to the bill in the enforcement and penalties section, and also some suggestion on the listing out of all of the various names of the known synthetic drugs that are on packages. I contacted our legislative counsel, the drafter of the bill, Kathleen Strassbaugh, and that's the how the legal memorandum that you have in your packets was generated. It is her opinion that the enforcement and penalty section does not need to be changed, and in fact, if it were changed to a civil penalty, that would result in the department, it would be necessary for them to file a civil lawsuit to prosecute anybody, and so by not changing that section, it remains a violation and can simply be written a citation for. And also, what we did do though was I requested that all of the listing of names be removed from the bill because it's probably going to be very quickly outdated and unnecessary, and we would have to return to revisit it probably every year. So those are the two changes in the CS. I do want to remind you that there's two fiscal notes that are zeroed out from the Public Defender's Agency and the Office of Public Advocacy that would need to be adopted with this version. So with that, that's my presentation.
Thank you. You've done a lot of work on the bill. I was disappointed that we couldn't get the names in the uncodified law, but it's on the record, and that will help. We have state troopers online for questions, and we have Kathleen online for questions. Any comments or questions by the committee? And by the way, my compliments to Representative Foster has a question.
Oh, sorry, or a comment. You mentioned comments. Thank you. I also just wanted to speak in support of this. This bill, I up in Nome have, you know, this has actually come out to rural Alaska, to places like Nome, and surprisingly, and I had a mother who told me about how her son was affected by spice, and how it just wreaked havoc with his plans to move forward in life, and so recently our regional native nonprofit, Quirik, had a regional conference, and amongst a number of issues, this was one issue that came up. And it's just gained a lot of visibility, and it's something that our region has wholeheartedly come out against the drugs and very much in support of the bill. And so I just wanted to, you know, as we close this out, just make those comments. So thank you.
I just wanted to thank the Kathleen For the memo, the second page there, the description between violation and offense was well done. I think I'm going to try to make a visual out of that so I can maybe remember it a little better. Okay, so I'm going to close public testimony. As before the committee, if there's further comments or action. And when you move, if you're ready for action, move the bill with the updated zero fiscal notes.
Mr. Chair, I would move House CS for CS for Senate Bill number 173 with updates, and that would be 28-LS1242/Y, individual recommendations, and these attached updated fiscal notes from this committee.
Okay. Seeing no objection, we're just left cranking today. Okay, we move that bill. Okay, that leaves us with the last bill that we had on the slate, I believe, for today, which is HB 45. We're going to take a little at ease until we tell us about HB 45.
All right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Page, staff to Representative Costello. And House Bill 45 is an act relating to harassment, intimidation, or bullying by students attending public schools in the state. This bill was proposed by a senior from Diamond High School, and we've followed up to make this happen. So I will just go through a sectional analysis quickly. On line 7, section 1, deletes language, whether verbal or physical, when specifying what type of harassment, intimidation, or bullying is being conducted. So basically this indicates that no matter the form of delivery, it shall be reported to school administrators by any witness. Section 2 of the bill inserts electronic or communication and into the definition of the type of harassment, intimidation, or bullying. So putting this into context with the rest of the statute, currently the schools have to have harassment policies, and this is simply updating the definition to say that electronic forms of communication are also considered harassment, intimidation, or bullying. It has no effect on the weight of different actions. It doesn't dictate what type of disciplinary action the school districts will take, just that they need to amend the policies.
And just for clarification's sake, we want to make sure that you are speaking from version uniform.
Yes.
Okay, and if you would, Vice Chair. Yes,
I would move House Bill number 45 from this committee.
No, for discussion.
For discussion.
Yeah.
Well, I meant for discussion. Yeah. Don't pay attention to what I say. Pay attention to what I mean. for discussion, HB 45. Well, maybe we should just go ahead with it. 28-LS02-56/uniform. For discussion.
Okay.
Hopefully eventual movement.
Okay, I see no objection. So, any questions for the sponsor? Seeing none, we have a Ron here from NEA who would like to testify. So.
I tried, Ron.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Ron Furr, NEA Alaska President, representing 13,000 education support professionals and teachers, and advocating for 130,000 public school students. We support HB 45. Cyberbullying occurs in the shadows, and it can be difficult to detect. Whether online, Facebook, by text message, or some other means, it can be more difficult to detect and prevent than more conventional forms of bullying. Teachers and education support professionals are the first line of defense in stopping cyberbullying in schools. Cyberbullying carries over into the classroom. In fact, only 1 in 10 victims will will inform a parent or a trusted adult of their abuse. The consequences of cyberbullying are significant. Both traditional bullying and cyberbullying cause significant emotional and psychological distress. Like other forms of bullying, cyberbullied kids experience fear, low self-esteem, depression, and anxiety. Cyberbullying victims also experience some unique consequences, such as feeling overwhelmed, vulnerable, powerless, exposed, humiliated, isolated, and even disinterested in life. Bullying victims are 2 to 9 times more likely to consider committing suicide. According to Pew Research, about 1/3 of all teenagers who have used the internet have been the target of some form of cyberbullying. Cyberbullying, excuse me. Cyberbullying can be extremely humiliating and painful for students. Some research shows nearly 43% of kids have been bullied online, 1 in 4 more than once. 70% of students report seeing frequent bullying online. Cyberbullying is unacceptable. The only way to bring cyberbullying out of the shadows is a community effort by teachers, parents, administrators, and other students to send a clear message that cyberbullying will not be tolerated. HB 45 is the first step towards ensuring that Alaskan students can attend school in a safe learning environment free from the threat of cyberbullying. Thank you.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you for your testimony. You know, yeah, all types of bullying are bad and harmful. But, you know, the big kid on the playground bullying the little kid on the playground, that's bad, but it stops essentially that day or in a very short period of time, the consequences, I mean. Not that it's good. But on the cyberbullying, you put something on Facebook, you know, that's there forever. And that's what makes it so terribly bad. You know, all of us, you know, I have a cell phone. Most of us in this room have a cell phone. There's a camera on it. And you can take that camera and take it into restrooms and things like that and take pictures. And you're basically defenseless with it. And so, again, and that's there forever. You try to get a job 10 years later, they find that on the Internet. And so I very strongly support this bill. And as a former teacher, not so much during the cell phone era, but I can understand, you know, the consequences. Unless we try to do something, this won't fix it, but it'll certainly help.
Thank you.
Representative Du?
No, I'm not going to object to this bill. But I really have some problems, not just with this bill, which is cyber bullying, but I guess with all of the harassment statutes which don't go to physical harassment. I mean, I remember when I was a kid and I was in school, I got teased, you know, and sometimes that teasing was mean. Sometimes it was awful. And, you know, my
Representative Duke, if I could, I want you to continue, but okay. are you directing a question, if you back to the sponsor, because that's great.
I guess it's, you know, not really a question to the sponsor. It's when we discuss
We want the sponsor to be able to respond to that.
Okay.
So, you know.
All right.
Ron, you can stay there if you like, but Sarah, come on up, and then that way you'll know that you can respond. And I'm sorry to interrupt.
Okay. So, I mean, but, you know, I went home, and my dad told me, you know, remember, sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you. And yeah, they did hurt, but I mean, we can't let some of these statutes interfere with the First Amendment right to freedom of speech. And that's, you know, it's not just cyber, it's not just this bill. It's all of them that relate to people are just mean to each other. Sometimes people even hold other people's bills, which is a form of bullying. But I mean, we live with it.
Sarah, did you have a comment?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux. To address the beginning of your comment, this statute does address the physical act. So we're just acknowledging that it is in there in Section 2 under the definition of harassment, intimidation, or bullying. We're inserting electronic communication, but it does say physical act as well, with the intent of threatening, must be reported. So.
Follow up. I see that in A, but I don't see that in B or C or D. And I mean, so teasing, for example, which is just, you know, verbal teasing, might have the effect on some students of interfering with their education. I mean, if they're sensitive, but that's not necessarily physical harassment.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I see that. I see how that. I appreciate that comment, but I do think that it doesn't need to be repeated in B, C, and D because it is in the first definition. And B, C, and D are just really clarifying the intensity of the bullying or the teasing or what have you, if it's severe or persistent or substantially interfering. So I don't think we need to repeat physical in there, but thank you.
A similar question, if you would, Sarah, just explain why you took out whether verbal or physical out of sub B.
Chairman, whether verbal or physical was taken out of line 7 because we just wanted it to read, any student that has been subjected to harassment, intimidation, or bullying, period, whatever type. I feel if we didn't delete it there, we would have also had to insert electronic and then specify what types of acts. It's really just trying to say that any type of delivery of the harassment, so that we didn't have to reiterate the specification again in the definition.
Okay. This is probably a question that I'm going to direct at Ron, but you weren't here the other day when we had a bill that basically did the same thing, SB, but a different section of law. It was in Title 14. And my staff went back and looked at all the different areas where this is covered already in law. And this is, you know, and the only thing unique that I see really is the fact that we're pulling it into Title 14. And I'm trying to explain, help me understand if you have any in the education section of law. But there's also, you go into the criminal code and whatever, and I mean all the behaviors are already okay. Sarah, do you want this one?
Mr. Chairman, we do have legislative legal services here to talk about that.
Okay, well,
if you'd
like. Yeah, okay, that's fair enough, sure. Okay. Yeah, any other questions for the sponsor or for Ron? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony, and the bill is before us. Or total amendment, or no? I'm just teasing, Sarah. No.
She had a reaction.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'd happily move House Bill Number 45, 28L0256 /Lehman.
Uniform.
With individual recommendation, any attached fiscal notes, and our good wishes.
Seeing no objection, we're going to go ahead and gavel out, and it may be the last time.
So I'd just like to state on the record before you gavel out, if this is the last time, appreciate service on this committee. I'd like to thank you for the great job you've done as chairman of this committee.
Well, you're welcome, and I really enjoyed the year. I don't think it'll ever be duplicated. It's a good committee. It's very positive. So, yeah, thank you. And we're going to gavel out, but I'm not going to say it's the last time because of the fact that we don't know exactly what panic bill might come our way. So, don't get your hopes up too bad. We'll see what happens. Representative Grunberg.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to thank you and the other members of the committee for the courtesy and I dare say affection you've shown the minority on this committee. I was going to say bad judgment, but then I thought I'd leave that alone.
You can include respect and appreciation.
It works both ways.
Okay.
And I've really enjoyed this committee. It's been a fun 2 years.
And thank you to our good help. We're going to gavel out at 2:25.